This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Alice, verse Taftet 29. Elohim, and God said, Hinei nosati lochem eskul esev zorea zera, asher al pnei chol haaretz. Behold, I have given to you all the grass which is able to regenerate itself, asher al pnei chol haaretz, which is all over the land, veskul haaretz asher boi pri eitz zorea zora, and every tree which has a fruit which is capable of regenerating itself, lochem yehiye l'ochlo, you're permitted to eat that. Ulechol chaya sa'oretz ulechol oif hashamayim, and for all the beasts of the earth and the birds of the heavens, ulechol roimes al ha'oretz, and all the insects on the ground, asher bo nefesh chayo, anything with a living life, es kol yerek esev la'ochla, I've given them all the greenery, green grassy stuff to eat, vayehi chayin, and it was so. Just an interesting point here, we're not going to spend much time on these two psukim. That is the hopelessness of trying to sort one's way out without halacha. Are you allowed to murder other people? Let's think without halacha. Is a man allowed to murder another man? So we'll say clearly not. But what happens if the other fellow gets in the way? What happens if you need to murder him to get on with your job? You don't need terribly much brains to know that even that wouldn't be a nice thing to do. To murder somebody else because you need to get on with a job also wouldn't be a nice thing to do. Okay, so let's accept. So you can work out intellectually that you're not allowed to murder. Let's accept. What about an animal? Are you allowed to kill an animal? So now there's already a machlokes between the vegetarians and the non-vegetarians. Everybody agrees you don't just kill an animal for fun. To kill an animal to eat, there are two views. There are some that say certainly not. What right have you got to kill an animal because you want to be because you're hungry? And there's some who say it doesn't matter. That's what an animal's created for. On what do they base the argument? Nothing. Their own personal opinions. Nobody has any basis for the argument, whatever. So let's say we'll say that you're not allowed to eat animals. Let's say we'll come to the conclusion that animals are not allowed to be killed. And what about vegetation? Are you allowed to eat vegetables? Now, for some reason, nobody stopped to think about that. They all stop at animals. Most people hold that human beings, you're not allowed to kill. Animals, you're allowed to kill. Some hold human beings, you're not allowed to kill, and animals, you're not allowed to kill. But nobody holds that you're not even allowed to kill the flowers and the grass and pick fruit off the trees. Why not? Who gives us the right to eat fruit off the trees? Who tells us, on what basis do we know that you're permitted to destroy fruit from the trees, but you're not permitted to kill an animal? Who draws that distinction? The scientists don't even know where the plant world ends and the animal world starts. But they're not even sure of that. So the two are very closely connected. They both have a life of their own. So animals can walk around, plants can't walk around. Who tells us animals have got blood, plants haven't got blood? Who tells us that the one you can kill and the other one you can't? Nothing. Just plain, simple convenience and people's own opinions and that. So there's no basis for it. Without halacha, there's no basis to allow oneself to eat a vegetable. That's it. If you start with the premise that you're not allowed to kill another human being, then you're not allowed to pick a piece of grass either. That's it, on the same basis. If you're going to use your own intellect to figure it out, your own intellect, you'll say, what right do you have to kill another human being because you're hungry or because you need some business? What right do you have to kill an animal because you want to eat? Okay then, what right do you have to pick a piece of fruit because you want to eat it? So one has to resort to halacha. Here we have the heter. The Torah finds it necessary to tell us in clear language that you're permitted to eat vegetation. Vegetables are permitted. But the source is the Chumash. And it's a little bit like the Hashomer HaTzair people in Israel now are beginning to question the whole justification of the Jewish people to the state of Israel. And they're beginning to say the Arabs are right. What right have we got to stay in the land of Israel? Just because we conquered it and we chased them out from their homeland, does that give us the right to stay here? And they ask their parents and their teachers, on what basis do we have the right? Oh, the Bible, they tell them. And the youth of the Hashomer HaTzair are already saying, in that case, we listen to the Bible so carefully about whether we're allowed to stay here or we're not allowed to stay here. What about the other things the Bible says?
And there's already conflict in how can one be selective in the Bible? You'll choose this from the Torah that you want and this from the Torah that you don't want. The whole of Yiddishkeit falls to pieces once you start becoming selective. Yiddishkeit has a whole dynamics of its own. It's like taking a human body and taking out the heart and accepting the rest of it, or taking out the brains, or taking out the eyes. It's not the same anymore. That's not how it's meant to function. Pick the eyes out of Yiddishkeit and you're not left with Yiddishkeit, you're left with Reform Judaism. And it makes no difference if the only thing you don't accept is shatnez. Let's say you accept everything else, but the one thing you can't accept is that there's anything wrong with having linen and wool mixed together in your garments. That's all you can't accept. You're a Reformed Jew if that's all you can't accept. And it makes no difference. There is no difference in stature between that man that we've just described, who keeps the whole Torah. He learns day and night. He gives charity. He's kind. He keeps Shabbos. He keeps kashrus. They keep Taras HaMishpocha, they keep the laws of family purity. She covers her head correctly and properly, and she wears a shetel or a tichel or whatever it is that she wears. Everything fantastic. One thing, shatness, that they don't do. That person is on the same level spiritually and Jewishly as the man who doesn't keep Shabbos and doesn't keep kashrus and doesn't keep anything. I'm not talking about a man who doesn't keep shatness or doesn't keep one thing because he can't bring himself to it, or it's inconvenient, or he hasn't learned about it and doesn't understand. But a man who says, that's not for me. I'm selective. Once you're selective, it's not Yiddishkeit. Now, a man who comes along and says, who eats vegetables, there is no justification to eat vegetables except the chumash. God made them, and God will decide what you can do with them. You want to accept the heter and the chumash to eat vegetables? Okay, then accept the rest of it. The beginnings of inconsistency start already here. On the sixth day, we're not even out of the days of creation. And one's already seeing the obligations imposed by the learning of chumash. We're not even talking about Gemara and Halacha yet, we're just talking about chumash. If one learns chumash and one wants to accept chumash, then one has to accept an awful lot. You can't stop halfway.
Bayar Elokim et kol asher aso, and God saw everything that he did. Vihinei tov ma'od, and behold, it was very good. And it was evening and it was morning and it was the sixth day. What's the difference between this posuk and the way all the other days are finished off? An extra hey, hashishi. The others don't say the fifth day or the fourth day, they just say fifth, fourth day. And here it says this sixth day. What else? The very good tov ma'od. Everything else was just tov. It was good, this is tov ma'od. What else? No.
Vayar is probably also a point. I'm not sure if that others have got a Vayar or not. No, they've all got Vayar. What else is there? You've given all the well-known ones. Now give the credit. No? Yes, okay. Kol Asher Aseh, you saw everything. Okay, now one more left. No. An actual word which is different. Sorry? No. That's part of the call, really. It's part of the same thing with call. A little word. Hinei. In the others it says ki tov, and here it says hinei tov ma'od. What's the difference between ki and hinei?
Says the Klei Yoker, quite correctly, of course, that ki is when something is still in potential. Vayar Elokim, and God saw that it was good, meaning that it could be good. In Hebrew, that one has to understand. One mustn't just translate into English and then think in English. When you use the word ki, there's a little bit of something indefinite about ki. It means almost that which may be will be. If it's dependent on something, it's not absolutely independent when you use the word ki. All the other days it says Vayar Elokim ki tov, and God saw that it was good in potential. Comes the sixth day, he nay, behold, it is good. This is not dependent on anything anymore. Vayar Elokim, and God saw, he nay, tov moed, this is excellent. Others were only ki tov, and this is he nay, behold, tov moed, it's excellent. What's changed? The moed has changed. There's something extra. On every day, something new was created. The first day, something new was created. On the second day, something new was created. On the third day, something new was created. So the ma'od, the very good, can't be referring to an extra quantitative thing. So the fact that there was another bria, was that man was created on the sixth day. But something new was created every day. So what does it mean, very good? Tov ma'od.
was exceedingly good. What would say exceedingly good about the sixth day, or about this last stage of creation, more than everything else? Sorry? So number one, they're interacting. It's already a whole. They're not separate pieces. That's the one point which is clear. Yeah? That's the same point here. That it's complete. The other point which the Medrash points out is that the letters of Ma'od are the same letters as the letters for the word Adam, man. The one who can change something from being mediocre and being into being excellent is man. Ma'od, the concept of exceedingly something, exceedingly anything, is something which man can do. That's a very important concept in Yiddishkeit which is foreign to most other cultures. Because normally we hold, or most other cultures hold, that untouched beauty is the most magnificent of all. You go to the Drakensberg or somewhere and you get somewhere where it's just untouched by humanity. That's the most beautiful. It is very beautiful. But that's not Tov Ma'od. That's not this extra quality of beauty which only a human being can introduce into a scene. Changes altogether when a human being is there. What changes becomes dynamic. Until a human being is there, everything is programmed. It's like a computer. God programs it, and God watches it step by step, but it all develops and unfolds one after another. You look at a little flower in the morning, and it's a closed bud, and you look at it in the afternoon, and it's a little bit more open, and you know exactly how it's going to be tomorrow morning. It's going to be still more open, and finally it will open up as a flower, and then bees will start coming around it, and then it will start wilting, and it will die, and you know exactly what's going to happen. And people plan their gardens that way. They know that if they plant something here, it will grow in such a way, and it will go nicely with the thing next to it, and so it goes on. It's all absolutely programmed. The world starts becoming unpredictable and dynamic when you've got a man there, because then you don't know. It was a flower there yesterday, today it's gone, somebody's picked it. It was a flower there yesterday, today there too, somebody transplanted something else. Once there's a human being mixing around, then you never know what's going to happen. Of course, the tragedy is when the human being becomes a flower, and he also becomes predictable. And you can tell exactly what he's going to do as well, and you see him in the morning, and you know, 5:30, the alarm clock goes, hopefully. And if everything's programmed correctly, he starts stretching, and he gets out, and he does negavasa, and he gets dressed, and he has a shower, and he gets dressed, and he comes to davening, and he finishes davening, and he learns Chaya Odom, and he finishes Chaya Odom, and he has breakfast, finishes breakfast, he says goodbye to his wife, he gets into his car, he goes to the work, he comes home from work, davenes mincha, davenes ma'ariv, he says hello to his wife, and so it is absolutely programmed. That's not the kind of man we're talking about here. That's not what God was happy about on the sixth day when he said, Tov Ma'od, this is fantastic. He wasn't talking about this kind of guy that's programmed like the rest of the world, because he's just a flower like everybody else. That's not something to get excited about. Tov Ma'od is when the world starts becoming dynamic. When things start changing, things start happening. Beyond, so to say, kebeyochel, as if beyond the control of God himself, in the sense. God gave the raw material and then says to man, now let's see what you can do with it. And now the nachas, the pleasure of God, comes from watching to see what the human being does with the world, not to see what he did. Tov is up till now, ki tov, everything's been very nice. God's made it and he makes things very perfectly. But we don't admire Greek classical art. It's not something we get excited about. It's very perfect Greek classical art. They've worked it out to a very fine art. It's mathematically perfect. But it doesn't inspire much. It doesn't. If you look at it analytically and you measure and you see and the proportions are just right, you can admire it intellectually, but it doesn't burn your heart to see Greek classical beauty. Because that's something which is, in a sense, godly. It's perfect. Perfection is not something which stirs us. What stirs us is uniqueness, effort, specialness, change, dynamicism, putting two incomplete things together to make one complete thing. Brilliance. That's what encourages us. That's what makes us excited. And that's what makes the Ribbono Shel Olam excited. Not just seeing the world. Can you imagine before Adam was created? Before a human being was there? Can you imagine how perfect the world was? Everything was just as it should be. It was, every blade of grass was put there by the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. Every tree was put in its place by the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. It was untouched, uninterfered with, totally. It was only 6 days old, the whole thing. Can you imagine the beauty? But God doesn't get excited about that beauty. When does he get excited? When Adam's there. Adam starts messing around and he starts eating from the tree, and the Ribbono Shel Olam knows that that's what's going to happen. Doesn't matter. That's Tov Ma'od. That's good. He's going to suffer for it, and that's not good. He's going to disobey me, and that's not good in one sense, but in the other sense, things are happening. Things are moving. It's not all programmed. It's not boring. things that the potential is limitless when there's dynamicism. When it's programmed, the potential is totally limited. You can have the most brilliant computer that can do the most wonderful things, but it's limited. It has a limit. A human being who's stupid, you can take the most stupid of human beings, who doesn't have, or on the surface, doesn't appear to have 1/1,000,000th of the capacity of a computer. Doesn't matter. He's limitless. He doesn't have 1/1,000,000th of the capacity of the computer, but in 5 years' time, he'll be able to go so much further, and he'll still be in date, whereas that computer will be out of date. The computer is limited in its brilliance to its parameters. And the world before man is created is limited in its beauty, but it's limited beauty. Only certain things can happen to it. Once man comes in, anything can happen. Absolutely limitless. Now, there are two midrashim on this that we're going to do, which I'm sorry, I didn't have a chance to focus that. And they're on the words ma'od. They're both very famous ones, but they're, like many things, they're famous but not understood. The first one we're going to do says the following. Omar Rabbi Shmuel bar Yitzchak, Hinei tov ma'od. What does this mean, very good? What was so very good? There are many midrashim on this word ma'od, trying to understand what is it that God got exhilarated about. Listen to this one. What's this that God got so exhilarated about, that it's no longer ki, but it's hinei, and it's no longer just tov, but it's tov ma'od? It's very good, exceedingly good. You see the first sign of excitement on the part of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Midrash. Hinei tov, ze malach chai. The goodness that he's been speaking about all the time, that's talking about the angel of life. Hinei tov ma'od, but this fantastic thing that's been created on the sixth day, ze malach hamoves, that's death. It's weird. And the Midrash asks, and what's so good about that? What's so fantastic about that? Itzma, this is amazing. Then the Midrash gives its answer, which I'll read to you after I'll explain it. Imagine that I say to you, come on, take a bet what the gold price will be tomorrow. How long will it take you to give me the answer? Let's try it out. Take a bet. Let's just see. What will the gold price be tomorrow? Take a bet. Okay. It took each one, I don't know, a half a second to make their guesses. Imagine I said, come on, be a sport. 500 rand on the gold price tomorrow. What will it be? It's different all of a sudden. What changes? We're talking about the same gold price. He knows so much. He's such an expert. It took him half a second. He could tell us what he thinks the gold price will be tomorrow. And now we put 500 rand on the table and he starts scratching his head. And he's not sure whether he wants the bet altogether. And even if he's decided to go ahead with the bet, he sits and thinks, let's see, what was it today, and why did it go up today, and what was the tendency over the last couple of days, and let's read the newspaper, what's happening, let's listen to the latest news, let's figure out, give me a moment or two, let's find out what's going to happen. Start taking it seriously all of a sudden. And imagine we say 5,000 rand on the table, come on, bond your house, but five, be a mensch, come on, you call yourself a maven, let's see what the gold price will be, whoever is closer, you or me, 5,000 rand on the table. We've worked hard for that 5,000 rand. And if we lose it, we're going to work jolly hard to replace it, and we both know that, but it's fun. Come on, let's have a bit of fun. 5,000 rand on the table. People do this kind of thing. Then can you imagine the thought that goes on? The pain of the working it out and the figuring it out, and the sleepless night to night after we put it in our sealed envelopes. Did we do enough homework? And the stupid, why did I say, of course it's going to go down. Why did I say it's going to go up? It can't go up anymore. And the other one who said that the price is going to go down, has his sleepless night, and he thinks, how stupid of me, why should it go down tomorrow? It's been going up all the time, it's going to be higher. And nobody sleeps that night, and everybody's worried. That's what it is, for 5,000 rand, that's a lot of money. But a colleague of mine, not a rabbinical colleague, somebody else, was at this new place in this neighboring country, what's it called? Sun City, that's right, he was in Sun City. And he was present when the fellow sitting next to him, who we both know, lost 30,000 rand. One go like that. 30,000 rand on the table, gone. So So I was thinking to myself, and if there was 30,000 rand on the table, can you imagine then, no matter how wealthy you are, makes no difference. 30,000 rand is already money. Can you imagine then what goes on? And let's say it's not gambling and betting on the gold price. Let's say it's the stock exchange, where there's a bit of chokhmah to it as well. Partly gambling, but partly chokhmah. Where you can figure out, where you can do your homework, where you can get company reports, and you can study, and you can work. And the gold price, there's only so much work you can do. You're playing roulette, there's no work you can do at all. But let's take something which really requires a bit of safe. And we say, come on, what are we sitting here? We're not going to make money this way. Let's both go to the building society, and let's take out massive bonds on our house, 30,000 rand each, and let's put it on a share on the stock exchange. Let's make some money quickly. Now what homework goes in then? But imagine, so to say, that Khomeini woke up in a good mood, and he calls his 50 American students together, and he says, let's have a bit of fun here. We're playing with the gold price here, we Iranians. You 50 Americans, tell us what the gold price is going to be tomorrow. The one who comes last is killed. Can you imagine then what goes on? Now you're playing with life. That's different altogether. Unless the stakes are high, people don't take them seriously. That's just human nature. It's only when the stakes are high that things become what they call exciting. Now what does exciting mean? Exciting means that you have responsibility. That's what excitement's all about. You want to feel that if you make a mistake, it's your fault and you get hammered for it. But if you do it right, it's your credit and you get the reward for it. That's what excitement is. Walking across a tightrope is exciting. If you make it across, you're going to get applauded. But why are you going to be applauded? Because if you didn't make it across, you would have fallen and killed yourself. That's responsibility. You're totally responsible for yourself at that moment. Nobody else is responsible for you. Nobody can help you. Nobody can harm you. It's you. And you have to suffer or reap the benefits of your own action. That's exciting, and that's responsibility. And that's the difference between a fellow who works for a salary and a man who works in his own business. The Gemara says, Roitza Adam Bekav Shelo Mitisha Kabin Shechavera. A man would rather have one measure of his own than nine measures of somebody else's. It means that it's human nature to rather be satisfied earning 1,000 rand a month from your own business rather than 9,000 rand a month from somebody else's business. No fun working in somebody else's business. You get the same salary check at the end of every month, no matter how goodly or badly you perform. That's not exciting. There's no responsibility. But when you're building up your own business and every decision is critical and it's going to affect you who knows in what way, and that's going to decide whether the business is going to be successful or it's going to be unsuccessful. And if it's going to be successful, your whole family will be able to live from it and your children will have a future and everything's fine. And if it's unsuccessful, you're all in a mess. That's when it becomes important and that's when it becomes exciting. But when one's life is in danger, then it's again a different game altogether. Then it becomes exciting to the extreme. But we have to realize, and that's what the Ribbono Shel got excited about, this invention of death. Take man's most precious currency and make that the stakes. That's it. Finished. That's what God does with the world, with the owner. He says, this is a business. You're in it as a business. You're here to make a profit. We're giving you 70 years, 80 years, 60 years, who knows how many years. We're giving you enough time. Enough time to make as much profit as you need to see you through the rest of eternity in Olam Haba. We're giving you all the utensils you need, all the tools you need. Did anybody see the film The Cockle Shell Heroes when it was out many years ago? Anybody see it? Nobody seen it. So, you've read the book. Is anybody else who hasn't read the book nor hasn't seen the film? Everybody's read the book. Haven't even read the book. Unbelievable. So these were the things that my father used to take me to, like he used to take me to the Beis HaMidrash to learn Gemara. There were certain things that one had to see. The Cockle Shell Heroes, where they were training a special band of soldiers in the war, a very small and elite crack group. And the way they trained them was, they basically took them in an aeroplane and dropped them by parachute. They had no idea where they were. They had no money. They had no identity cards. They had nothing. Absolutely nothing. And they had to get back by a certain time to headquarters. They had to find out where they were, but they didn't know if they were in enemy territory or they were in their own territory. So they couldn't stop the nearest person and say, tell me what country I'm in, please. Because if they were in enemy territory, they would be caught out immediately. So they had to discover very quickly where they were and start acting in the right way to know, do you act as one of them or do you hide from them? What do? If you're in an allied area and you hide from them, if they find you, they'll shoot you. And if you're in an enemy area and you don't hide from them, they'll also shoot you. And then they had to borrow money, and they had to get lifts, and they had to transport themselves, and they had to make it by a certain deadline. That's what the Olam Hazeh is all about. That's what this world is all about. The Rebbeinu Shem says, I'm putting you down. Some will be dropped in South Africa, some will be dropped in America, some will be dropped in Israel, some will be dropped in Europe. It makes no difference where. You've all got to come back to the same place. You're all coming back to me. And I'm fixing the time when you've got to be back here. And you've got to come back here with your pockets full. That's it. And you've got every opportunity to do it, but you must know. It's not just that if you make it, you come back with your pockets full and you've got the reward. Imagine taking a bet from the gold price tomorrow, and I say, look, if you win, 1,000 rand to you. If you lose, don't worry. That's no fun. The thing that makes it exciting and creates the responsibility is the dual relationship. If I win, I'm rewarded. If I miss, I'm punished. I suffer. That's what makes it real. That's what makes it responsible. The Banishan says, don't think that if you come here with your pockets empty, that okay, so you'll come with your pockets empty, so you've lost the game. No. You're dead. Your life's at stake. That's it. See that sword over there? That's it. Anybody who comes here without their pockets full, that's the end of them. You might say think or feel that's a very unkind and insensitive sort of God. But not at all. Because it's no fun for the successful ones if that sword isn't there and if the failures aren't going to be knocked out. It only becomes worthwhile for the successful ones if they know that it was worthwhile being successful and that those that didn't put in the effort are going to be knocked out. Otherwise, what's the fun and what's the purpose of putting in the effort? What's the idea of swatting your head off to do well in exams, and you make it and you get your A, and Nebuch, there's somebody next to you who messed around the whole year and then only realized too late that they'd been messing around, they say, no, we'll give you an A also. Shame, why should you go without an A? What's it like for the person who really worked? It's not worthwhile. There's no responsibility again. That's what's wrong with the whole communistic system of economy. The fact that we have to share out everything equally between those who try and those who don't try, that's against the whole morality of what the world is all about. The world is all about those that try within reason, we'll see in the other side of the coin in a moment, are rewarded. Those that want to laze can enjoy themselves lazing. But not only won't they be rewarded, they'll actually be slaughtered. That's it. The life's on stake. And now it's altogether a different thing, because now you're just about getting into bed late at night and you suddenly remember that when you said Kriya Shema it was too early. It was still before dark. And you don't know Kriya Shema by heart. And your wife's already asleep and the light's off and the whole house is locked up. Now it's a question, do you say Kriya Shema or don't you? So you decide you'll say Kriya Shema. Not worth getting on the wrong side of God. But you go up and you find a siddur and you put on the light and you go looking and you... Or do you just try and battle through it by heart? Your life's at stake. It's not a question of Kriya Shema or not Kriya Shema. It's a question of life or death. That's it. And you might say, okay, how much life, how much death? I don't know. One Kriya Shema can make the difference between real life and real death. But even let's say it makes the difference of 5 minutes. Let's say for not saying Kriya Shema with all your heart, for saying it mediocrely, God says 5 minutes off your life. That's 5 minutes of your life is not so terrible. But you know, I had a math teacher once who told us the following in class. He said, look, this was in Form 1. He said, you kids might think that it's not serious to fail Form 1. He says, but you don't realize you're not failing Form 1. You're failing your last year of working life. What does it mean? It's very simple. In Form 1, you fail, a year is nothing. He says, but if you start working a year later, you must realize that when you reach 65 at retirement age, or whatever it will be, you've worked for 1 year less, and that's what's cut off. It's your earning power at the end that's one less. Now, are you with me? Because the whole thing is progressing geometrically, and it's all pushed off that you're working for 1 year less, and where does it come off? Your most productive year, not now, not for one. It's all shoved along. You start a year later, but you finish a year earlier. And it's like that with life as well. One thinks, oh, when I'm an old man, and I'll be sick in bed, in any case, what's 5 minutes of my life? It's not terribly serious, it's not so. Because as precious as 5 minutes are of our lives now, do you know what 5 minutes is going to be like at the end of our lives? It just gets, you know how time goes faster and faster, and how a year used to schlep, and then a year didn't schlep anymore, and then a year started flying, and it just flies faster and faster and faster and faster. That's because it's becoming more intense and more important. And those last years of one's life are the most important of all. And the last days of one's life are the most important of all, and the last minutes of one's life. You know what you can achieve in those last minutes? And the focus of spirituality and intellect in those last moments? You don't have to worry about anything. You have no negias. You have no, you're not an interested party in the outcome of your intellectual reasoning. You can believe in the Rabbeinu Shalom without worrying about what will it impose on me to believe on him. Because you're about to die. So you can believe in him with a totally clear and an absolute undertaking of belief, which is impossible to achieve during lifetime. And there's debates as to whether, because maybe if the person's suffering physically at such a time, maybe you should take those last 5 minutes of life away from him. And the idiocy of it. It's quite obvious, it sounds a bit ironical, but it's quite obvious that the people who debate euthanasia are people who've never been in that position. So when we talk about life and death, and when you're lying in bed and it's a question of do you bother to get up for a siddur, you don't, and you're talking about 5 minutes life or 1 minute life or whatever it is, it's the best 5 minutes. It's not just any 5 minutes, it's the best 5 minutes. And now one understands in a little bit more depth what would otherwise have appeared to be a pretty little medrash, but nothing terribly serious. Elon Melach she'osa su'udot, similar to a king who makes a party, v'zimen esa orchin, and he invites his visitors, v'hichnis lifneim tamchui molei kol tov, and he brings before them a banquet filled with all the best food. Omar, he says, kol shemishu oichel mevareches hamelech yoichel v'yeravlo, anybody who eats, and as he's eating he praises the king for his generosity and for the sumptuousness of the meal, should eat and enjoy. The kol mishu oichel v'enu mevareches hamelech, but anybody who eats and doesn't bless the king, listen to the words he uses. I wasn't choosing words or images just out of the blue. Yutaz roishoy b'tsayif, his head will be severed with a sword. That's it. Not just will be escorted out, or will be his life will be terminated. No, his head will be chopped off. That's it. Those are the two possibilities. So you'll say, what kind of a world is that? So everything's just out of yira, it's out of fear. They'll sit at the table and they'll praise the king because they're scared of losing their heads. What kind of praise does the king get out of that? What's the point for the king even? It's not like that. It's that you know that it's so important, and there's such responsibility attached now to your praising of the king. You'll make sure that you enjoy that food properly. You'll make sure that you take and notice how good the food really is, so that when you praise the king it will be genuine and it will have integrity to it and it won't be false. That's what the king wants. He wants you to really enjoy your food. And it's only if you know that by not enjoying your food your head will be chopped off, that you really know, can learn how to enjoy it properly, that you can really put the required effort into it. It's not sufficient to take a glass of water and say, drink it, and even to say afterwards, that's not the purpose of a bracha. The purpose of a bracha is that you should be so infused with the beauty and the tastiness and the usefulness of the water, that you're motivated to be mevarech the Rabbeinu Shalom, to praise the Rabbeinu Shalom. And if you knew that there was a sword hanging over your head, and that sword hung on the thread of the type of bracha you said, you would be careful to make sure you said the right bracha, and that you didn't skip out any words, and that you didn't skip out any letters, and that you meant every word that you said, so that there should be no chas v'shalom, the king can't come and say to you afterwards, did you really mean that? There would be no chance of it, whatever. You would make sure that it was for real, that you knew what it really depended on. The stakes are high. That's what the Medrash is here for. This Medrash is not here to terrify people or to terrorize people. That's not the purpose, to go around thinking with a sword on top of my head all the time. That's not our system of Yiddishkeit at all. It's simply to know it's fun. We're gambling. We're playing games. But the stakes are life. That's it. It's one fantastic game, life, over here. But it's real. And you're playing with life. So in the same way, as you know, if you try and gamble and you fear all the time as you're gambling about the money you might lose, or if you go into business worried about losing money, you'll lose. As sure as anything, you'll lose. You need a certain abandon, a certain gambling spirit, a certain generosity to throw your money around. And okay, you lose, you gain, and you do it with tekel, you do it as well as you can, but you can't sit and shiver and have sleepless nights all the time, because then you're in trouble. The same with Yiddishkeit. You can't afford to run around shivering and worrying about when the sword's going to fall. That's no good. But to gamble, to know you're playing big stakes, and that every little move is a business move with incredible implications in these stakes, that you can do. But that's fun. That's the challenge of living.
That's what they don't teach at university. university is a place where nothing matters. You can say what you like and you're not really held responsible. All that's important is that you pass your exam, and if you don't pass your exams, then you go again the next year and you do them over again, and it's not terribly serious, and daddy will pay for the second year too. University is a place where one's isolated from the real gambling world. There are no gambles at university. And so university students grow up without any kind of feel for the reality and the seriousness of life. And yeshiva is not like that. In yeshiva, yes, you're isolated from the normal business activity of the world, so that you're in business. And you understand that the quality of your Kriya Shema is a matter of life and death. And you understand that the quality of your chesed and the quality of your learning and the quality of your interpersonal relationships, you understand the stakes over here, are much bigger, and it's one of the first things they teach in yeshiva. The stakes are much bigger than the biggest business empire. When Harry Oppenheimer sits and takes a decision which might wreck Anglo-American or double its size, he's not playing with as big a stake as you are when you're deciding whether to say Lashon Hara or not to say Lashon Hara, whether to daven with Kavona or just to mumble the words out. The stakes are much bigger in the second case than they are in Harry Oppenheimer's case. And a yeshiva bocher learns that right at the very beginning. At university you never learn it. The opposite. At university nothing matters. And you can't develop a maturity when you're isolated from the world of cause and effect. When you're isolated from responsibility, you can't develop a maturity. And so university students have an inherent immaturity. The problem is that those are years that you need to mature. Those are important years for the purpose of maturity. And there's certain things you can't catch up later. So one has to be very careful altogether with one's own approach. Lastly is one other little medrash, and that one will end. Also on the same question of what this Tov Mo'od is. Hinei Tov Mo'od. Why does it say Vehinei Tov Mo'od, says the Medrash? Why does it say and it was good? It should just say Hinei Tov Mo'od, behold it was good. Again, this seems when the Torah uses the and, the Torah seems to be talking about two things simultaneously. So Hinei Tov Mo'od Zeyetzer Tov. The one thing that Tov Mo'od is Yetzer Tov. Vehinei Tov Mo'od. And this parallel thing which God is talking about, which he also gets excited about, the Yetzirah. This is the Yetzirah. Now there's a similarity here between these two medrashim, because what they're really talking about, the essence of the last medrash we did, was the necessity of both life and death. If there's no reward at the end of your trip, it's no fun. And if there's no punishment at the end of the trip, it's no fun. For if there's no reward for doing it right, it's no good, and if there's no suffering for doing it wrong, it's no good. You need both. And when you're balancing those two together, that's the art of living which makes it exciting. Here too, we've got an interesting concept of the need for both. The Tov Mo'od, which was so beautiful, what God gets so excited about, is the interplay between the Yetzirah Tov and the Yetzer Hara. What is the Yetzer Hara? Asks the Medrash, "V'chi Yetzer Hara Tov Mo'od?" Do you mean to say that you can refer to the Yetzer Hara as being extremely good? Not just good, mind you, but extremely good. I always say there's some people who paint the Yetzer Hara in a very black painting and talk Lashon Hara about him all the time, blame all their vices and all their problems on the Yetzer Hara, and release all their frustrations on the Yetzer Hara as if he's some little demon that hangs around and makes him get up to all sorts of mischief. Not so at all. The Rebbeinu Shlom calls the Yetzer Hara, this evil passion or whatever you want to call it, calls it Tov Mo'od. It's extremely good. Says the Medrash a funny thing, and with this we'll be able to analyze what the Yetzer Hara is and how not to handle it. She'ilule Yetzer Hara, were it not for the Yetzer Hara, loy bono adam bayis, nobody would build homes for themselves. Incredible thing. The Yetzer Hara to find a house for yourself. You're still looking for a house for yourself. Good, and it's just to look after that Yetzer Hara. The Loi Nosa Isha. A man wouldn't get married if it weren't for the Yetzer Hara. You need this. You don't get married still. You need a Yetzer Hara for that. The Loi Hoilid, and to have children. To have the responsibility and the expense of raising children. Who needs it? It's a Yetzer Hara to have children. The Loi Nosa Venosa. And people wouldn't do business. Like a Lachenkov, they do business. So Yetzer Hara to do business. So what's going on? There are a few questions. Firstly, the Medrash tells us
that if God wouldn't have given us a Yetzer Hara, we wouldn't have built houses, and there wouldn't be business, and we wouldn't get married, and we wouldn't have children. Let's say we can understand that. But it's not really true. So the Rebbeinu Shlomo says you must put on tefillin every morning. He doesn't give us a Yetzer Hara for tefillin, but we put on tefillin every morning. He says you do it, so we do it. The Rebbeinu Shlomo says you must keep Shabbos. You must keep kashrus. You mustn't talk Lashon Hara. We try our best. We do whatever we can. Why didn't the Rebbeinu Shlomo leave the Yetzer Hara out? Who needs the Yetzer Hara? It creates an awful lot of problems. Leave the Yetzer Hara out and simply instruct us. You shall build homes, you shall marry women, you shall have children, and you shall do business. Finish. The answer to that is that things on which Kiyum HaOlam depends, things on which the whole world depends, the Rebbeinu Shlomo doesn't trust to our Yetzer HaTov. That's it. Where it's your own responsibility, where you're walking the tightrope, that the Rebbeinu Shlomo is prepared to say, look, it's your game. Play it however you want. You want to kill yourself, here's the sword. And if you want to see how we do it, here, somebody's just coming in with his pockets empty. Just watch how we get rid of his head. Boom, and we see the head go. Yep, we'll do that to you also if you come with your heads empty. No problem, we don't mind at all. That's the rules of the game. Okay, that's fine. But when your actions can affect Kiyum HaOlam, can affect the whole world, say the Rebbeinu Shlomo says, no games. This is, I take care of that. And the Rebbeinu Shlomo gives us an inborn mechanism that whether we like it or not, we will build houses, we will get married, we will have children, and we will do business. So that there's absolute assurance that these things will continue, that they'll never stop and they'll never be left to the whims of our Yetzer HaTov, of our good inclinations. What is the Yetzer Hara? Well, we now know the Yetzer Hara, by definition, is that urge in a human being which drives him to build homes, to get married, to have children, and to do business. That is the Yetzer Hara, defined in the Medrash. What is that urge? It's really the urge to have what you don't have. That's really all it is. To have something that you don't have. To want more. That's the Yetzer Hara. Now, if there wasn't an urge to have more, let's put it this way. Sometimes there's certain chores that one has to do. You have to wash the dishes after the meal, and you know you have to do it, but you postpone it and you don't do it, and you try and get out of it, and you try and get somebody else to do it, and if there's any way you could, and then you start using paper dishes to save the trouble and you get out of it. You know you've got to do it. You know it's not nice to use paper dishes, but it doesn't matter. It's a chore and you don't like doing it. You've got to polish the floors, you've got to clean the cutlery. It's hard. Nobody likes doing it. You've got to go and buy a new car. It's also hard. You've got to choose one, find one, bargain with a price, sign all the papers. It takes much longer than cleaning the dishes. That's easy. Why? Yetzer Hara. That's all. Getting the new car fulfills the needs of the Yetzer Hara. You're getting something that you didn't have before. Whereas when you clean the cutlery, you're not. And when you clean the dishes, you're not. And when you clean the floors, you're not getting anything new. It doesn't satisfy the Yetzer Hara. Look what would happen if there wasn't the Yetzer Hara. We wouldn't buy ourselves cars, and we wouldn't buy ourselves houses. We would live in little ramshackle pandokis, the things that just that we didn't get wet. And maybe we wouldn't even bother about that. The animals sleep outside. We would have lived in caves. Wouldn't even be the need to find a house altogether. We wouldn't build communities. We wouldn't get married. We wouldn't have children. We wouldn't do business. Why should we? In the same way as we try and get out of all our other chores, so we would try and get out of these chores, because they are chores. Except they're chores that make the Yetzer Hara say, good. That's the only difference. They're chores which feed the ego. So you can now divide all the chores in the world into those chores which feed the ego and those chores which don't feed the ego. The Yetzer Hara is the drive to do those things which God regarded as sufficiently urgent to justify the creation of a Yetzer Hara. God didn't give us a Yetzer Hara to clean the dishes. You don't want to clean the dishes, eat out of dirty dishes. That's your problem. You don't want to clean your floor, that's your problem. You don't want to build a house, that's my problem, says God. You've got to build a house. And I don't even trust you to your Yetzer HaTov. I'm going to give you an inborn need to build a house. You've got to do business. You've got to get married. You've got to have children, because if you don't, the world stops existing. And that I'm not going to have. One little shtemiel like you messing up my world, that's not. You want to live in a mess, that's fine. You want to kill yourself, fine. You want to become immoral and destroy yourself? Fine. But don't destroy the world. So the Rebbeinu Shlom gives us the Yetzirah. In fact, in the next little few words of this, of the Medrash, he basically defines it. V'chein Shlomo Omer, and that's what Shlomo says in Kohelet, when he says, Ki hi kinos ish mere'ehu. What is the Yetzirah? It's jealousy of one man to another man. That's what Yetzirah is. Yeah, if you live in a society where there are no cars, where you've never seen a car, you don't have a desire for a car. So Yetzirah is really something which is dependent on what other people have got. It's a desire to conquer area which other people hold. That's what it is. It's conquest. It's to get things which other people say are valuable. That's it. And to make it yours. What goes wrong with the Yetzirah? Only one thing. The Yetzirah is now needed. Because if you don't have... Before that, let's just see what's the correct way to use the Yetzirah. So one uses it for these things. One builds houses. One does business and so on and so forth. But why did Tzaddikim have to have a Yetzirah? Why didn't God just tell, okay, Tzaddikim, you won't have a Yetzirah, because Tzaddikim, I know you'll do what I tell you. So without a Yetzirah, I'll tell you to build houses, and I'll tell you to marry, and I'll tell you to have children, I'm sure you'll do it. And the Tzaddik would, no question. But the Tzaddik needs his Yetzirah in other areas. A Tzaddik, if he didn't have a Yetzirah, would never learn more than the first Pasuk of Chumash. That's it. He would learn Bereishis, Bara, Lakim, Vashamayim, Vesaoret, and he would never move on from there. Because you can go deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. There's no limit to how deep you can go in. And why move on before I understand this properly? That is a Yetzirah to know what the next Pasuk says also. There's a Yetzirah to say, I finished Chumash, I finished Bereishis, I finished Chas, I know something. It's plain Yetzirah. It's a Yetzirah to break ground, to do new things, to cover new areas. That's where the Tzaddik uses his Yetzirah. He uses it in the development. He uses it in the development of quantity, which is necessary for quality. You can't have quality if you don't have quality. When does the Yetzirah get out of hand? And this is very important, because this is the key to happiness. There's only one thing which causes us unhappiness. That's the Yetzirah. Nothing else. No tragedy, no calamity can possibly cause a person unhappiness. Not possible. It can cause a person difficulty. Can create problems for a person. He has to grapple with them. He has to handle them. Sure, they're always problems, they're always difficulties, but it can't ruin a person's happiness. There's only one thing that ruins your happiness, and that's the Yetzirah, the old friend. And the Yetzirah can ruin the happiness of a millionaire who has no problems, and the Yetzirah can ruin the happiness of a poor man who has many problems. And if you don't have a Yetzirah, or if your Yetzirah is correctly handled, you can be a rich man who owns fortunes and you can be happy, or you can be a poor man who owns nothing and you can be happy. The enemy of happiness is this little guy, the Yetzirah, because his job is to make you want things you haven't got. Now that's fine, because that's the essence of ambition, provided it doesn't become kino. And the difference between kino and wanting things that you haven't got is that kino is wanting things that he's got, whereas healthy Yetzirah is wanting what I don't have. I want more. There's nothing wrong with that. I want more, let me try and get more. But I want it because he's got it. And I'm upset, I'm hurt the fact that he's got it and I haven't got it. And I'm going to work until I can get it too. That's the key to unhappiness. That's the way to ensure unhappiness. That is, when one allows one's need for quantity to disturb the quality of one's life, that's when it's no good. The Yetzirah is the need for quantity. The Yetzirah is that drive in a human being to be ambitious and to want more than he's got. A human being who doesn't have a healthy Yetzirah is totally impotent and useless in this world. There's nothing he can do for himself. He will never become great, and he will never do anything for others. He's just completely useless. For the potency that one needs to operate in this world, one needs a Yetzirah. But the purpose of the Yetzirah is to get more than you've got. The danger of the Yetzirah, that it becomes not to get more than I've got, but to get more than he's got, more than somebody else has got. And that's when it becomes unhappy. And therefore, says the Ribbono Shel Olam, what the Ribbono Shel Olam is so excited about is the relationship of the Yetzirah and the Yetzirah Tov. Because if you had a Yetzirah Tov only, there would be no progress. There would be that same stagnancy that we talked about. The fellow who gets up in the morning and does Negevasa and has a shower and gets dressed and goes to davening, the flower person. That person is a person really with a Yetzirah Tov, with no Yetzirah Ra. He doesn't want anything more today than he had yesterday. He just wants the same today as he had yesterday. For such a person, there's no dynamicism. That's nothing to get excited about. For progress, you need a Yetzer Hara, you need an ambition. I want more. That's the essence of ambition, and a healthy person needs that, provided he's got an equally healthy Yetzer HaTov. And the Yetzer HaTov keeps on saying to the Yetzer Hara, you want more? Okay, I don't mind, I'll get you more. But don't disturb me, that's all. Just leave me alone. I'm busy enjoying what I've got. In addition to enjoying what I've got, let's try and get more. You and me together. Yetzer Hara and Yetzer HaTov, we'll go together. I, the Yetzer HaTov, will ensure that I'm enjoying what I've got, and you, the Yetzer Hara, can go and you can get more. And then that will be fantastic. But don't distract me from enjoying what I've got. Don't make me so fixed and fixated on getting more that I cease to appreciate what I've got now. I'm so busy working for more that I can't enjoy what I've got. That's no good. It says that the Ribbono Shel Olam, he sees in the play of the Yetzer HaTov, the Yetzer Hara, the ideal in progress. The Yetzer HaTov, which looks after the retention of quality, and the Yetzer Hara, which looks after ambition. Yetzer Hara without Yetzer HaTov becomes jealousy, meanness, taiva, destruction, self-destruction. Yetzer HaTov without Yetzer Hara becomes a worm, a shlumil. Yetzer Hara and Yetzer HaTov together, greatness. That's where there's ambition, progress, quality and enjoyment. And that's why I always say that the meaning of the statement in Pirkei Avot, Ezehu Ashir, who is a wealthy man, Hasameach Bechelko, a man who's Sameach Bechelko, does not mean he who is satisfied with what he's got. That's an incorrect translation. It means Hasameach Bechelko, a person who can enjoy what he's got. Now, what's so rich about enjoying what you've got? To be able to get more than you've got without interfering with your enjoyment of what you have got. That's what being rich is all about. That's what being wealthy is all about. Makes no difference how much you've got. Wealth is not a measure of how much you've got, because that's relative. Wealth is a measure of the extent to which you can enjoy what you've got. Because let me tell you that an African in Soweto in a little shack with a piece of bread and a couple of kids and a hot mug of awful tasting black tea and a little rickety table and a couple of rickety beds, who can enjoy that is enjoying materialism more than Harry Oppenheimer. That's it. He has more wealth than Harry Oppenheimer. Harry Oppenheimer has it in the vault, but he's not enjoying it. This man, okay, all he's enjoying is a few little things, but he's enjoying it. It's worthwhile, it's pleasant, it's happy. Whereas Harry Oppenheimer has much more, but he's unable to enjoy it. That's Osher. That's wealth. And that's the relationship of the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer HaTov. I go out to work. Why do I go out to work? To get more than I've got today. I learn. Why do I learn an extra page of Gemara? To know more than I knew yesterday. That's my Yetzer Hara work. My Yetzer HaTov is fine. You learned an extra daf today. That means you've got to stay up an extra 2 nights tonight, an extra 2 hours tonight to revise that extra daf, to make sure that you understand what you've learned, to make sure that it's good, to make sure that it will stay with you, to make sure that it will change you. The Yetzer Hara sends me off to work and says, go and earn something so that we can buy something that we didn't have yesterday. The Yetzer HaTov says, that's fine, but don't come home at 8 o'clock at night when your kids are all asleep and you can't enjoy what you've got. You come home at 5 o'clock and you sit down with your family and you enjoy them in a nice, relaxed fashion. And if you can't, I don't want any more. I don't want a television set if we can't even enjoy the radio. I don't even want a bigger house if we can't enjoy the little house. First one has to be able to enjoy what one's got, and then one can go out conquering more. The point I want to make, and with this we end, is that these concepts are concepts in the Medrash itself. This is not something that I'm imposing onto the Medrash. I'm sorry, Zafir, that I don't have it photostated. But there's no other way to understand the Medrash. Not there's no other way. There are pshatim in the Medrash. But if one analyzes the Medrash and understands that the Medrash is not just a silly little story, and one understands that there's something basic which is being illustrated in the Medrash, then these are the points which are being illustrated. And all this is hidden, as well as very much more. The Medrash goes on for pages on these things. All this is hidden in the little words, Vihine Tov Ma'od, and behold, this something special was fantastic. The first sign of excitement, the first thing God gets excited about. He gets excited that He creates heaven and earth. He creates energy. He creates light. He creates sea and dry land. He creates the birds and the insects and the animals. He creates man, and there's still not excitement. Where's the excitement? Yetzer Hara and Yetzer HaTov. That shidduch, that excites the Ribbono Shel Olam. Death and life, the excitement of living, the gamble of life, that excites the Ribbono Shel Olam. But that's what the Torah is all about.